The world is changing at breathtaking speeds, with trends and fads popping up and passing away at breakneck pace. Against that backdrop of nearly constant upheaval, we welcome you to the Sunday Scotch Society. Yeah, yeah. Over delectable, sumptuous scotches and with the occasional good cigar in hand, we have open, honest, and uninhibited conversation about whatever strikes our fancy. Whether it's the critical issue of the day or a deep dive down the rabbit hole, we take it all seriously while having a good time. Join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation. So, welcome to the Sunday Scotch Society. I am K. Quincy Parker, and I'm joined by my co-pilot and partner in the journey that we take here on the Sunday Scotch Society every episode. And I will stop talking long enough for him to once again introduce himself.
Very happy to be here. Very tired today, Quincy. I am Matthew B. Kelly. How are you, man?
I am well. I had the virus.
Yes, recently. You sounded so well on the last episode that I just completely forgot.
Mm-hmm. And the virus having been now flushed out of my system, myself being back in circulation, being able to talk to people and be with people again, I drive to and from work along the Western Road, and that stretch of road past the poop deck west and headed further west all the way around the coast until you get to the old Fort Bay area. It's a stretch of road that is so beautiful. The sound of the breeze, the sound of the waves as they lap against the shore, the smell of the sea, the smell of the sea grape, the sun on the water, or even on a gray day, the different hues of blue and gray. We live in such a beautiful country, and I'm constantly being made conscious of that by, you know, you just look out the window pretty much anywhere, any day, and it's like, I can't believe this is like my home, right? It's just so stunningly beautiful. And we take it for granted in a way that I think is criminal, practically. The way I say it is, we live in paradise, but we live like niggas in paradise. You know, like people who don't own their ownership of the paradise in which they live. And so after being sick and being out on the road again, to just watch the sun sparkle on the waves, it's just a real pleasure. And so that's how I am. I guess a little maybe more philosophical than usual, but that's me. What about you?
Well, I'm going to toast to your indulgence in the beauty of the place that we live in just a bit. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think it's all peaches and cream. And, you know, I'm 100% behind people taking responsibility for themselves and their outlook, which does not take away the responsibility of the wider system, which also produces views, you know, from traffic in the morning.
Absolutely.
Not absolutely so great. But I am very glad that you were able to see the sparkling seas on your way to work.
Boy, I mean,
from your self-imposed quarantine.
It was isolation. Don't say the Q word. That's a different vibe.
No problem.
I grew up out east, and I remember going to primary school at QC. You know, it was, 20-minute drive from Sans Souci.
Do not age yourself like that, sir.
20-minute drive from Sans Souci along the Eastern Road and then along Village Road to QC. By the time my daughter was in primary school at QC, that ride had grown from, 20 minutes to, if you left at the wrong time, potentially 2.5 hours to make the same 20-minute drive.
Yep.
Literally 2.5 hours, mm-hmm. inching forward. And
when emission standards were much lower.
Dude, if we really have the traffic conversation, we really need to have the traffic conversation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, dude, it's on my list.
It's
whenever you're ready. I have the solutions, which will never be implemented. But
the solutions are anyway. So I want to start with the thing, because there's a couple of things I want to do differently, or
that's one of my favorite quotes from Legend of Korra.
Uh-huh.
Do the thing.
Yes. Okay. So let's do the thing. This week our dram is inspired by the conversation that we had with Reed Parker from Edrington last week. Edrington is the company that owns the Macallan single malt scotch, as well as the Glenrothes, mm-hmm. the Highland Park single malt scotches. It also owns the famous Grouse, which is the best-selling blended scotch in mm-hmm. Scotland. It owns Brugal Rum and the Naked Malt and Number 3 Gin and some other, some other good products. But last week I was continuing along my journey with the Glenrothes 12-year-old and listening to Reed discuss his reaction to the Macallan 18-year-old Sherry Oak. I was like, you know what? Matthew and I need to spend some time with the Macallan 18 Sherry Oak ourselves. And so that is our dram this week. And I am now going to do the thing. Ooh, wait. Can you smell as I pour that?
Not sure. Ooh, up. Oh, it has reached me.
You smell it, right?
Un poquito.
I mean, even before you hit the nose, it's just. It's not like the room just got full of candy.
I'm just going to let that.
Wow.
Be on the nose for quite a bit here.
Oh my goodness.
This reminds me, I tucked in this week. Week in Whiskey News, I tucked into a video by the Whiskey Tribe on YouTube. They're going through a backlog of things they've been sent with no promises to the companies, but this one is on Dewar's Double Series.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. In this premium package. First thing he opens, there's a pair of Bose headphones inside.
Okay.
Which he's going to be given a tour of the scotches by Dewar's master blender. And so the first thing she says is, you can go in for the nose as much as you want, but leave the sip to the end mm-hmm. as we go through all of the terrain and areas where these you're going to get various notes, and she's just going to tell you about the scotches of, well, Scotland. So haven't finished that yet, but I'm just going to let this nose linger for a bit because that certainly deserves it.
I'm getting candy. I'm getting dried fruit. I'm getting almond or some kind of almondine sort of flavor. I'm getting buttermilk.
Buttermilk. Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm gonna combine two of the things that you said. And actually, as I look at this, the legs that Reed spoke of last week, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... That is quite...
It's like you painted the inside of the glass, right? And it's just... It's the whole line of liquid moving down rather than just a single drop here or there. It's a beautiful thing. That is the oils that he's talking about from the aging process, right? So they age their oak for 2 years before they make the barrels. Then they make the barrels and let it age for another year and a half with Spanish sherry sitting in the barrels. And that's where the sherry oak casks come from. And it is that pre-aging before they even make the barrels that allows the oils and the wood to develop so that it coats the inside of the barrel in a way that allows the scotch to sit and mature in a beautiful and complex way. And this is,
you know, it tickles me pink. The development of scotches in terms of like how they're experimenting with barrels. In particular, I find it humorous that you will get scotch aged in bourbon barrels. Like that's just the perfect circle of life there, right?
And for our guests who are just joining us on the journey and may not understand why you see an irony in that, you know, the fact is scotch is a type of whiskey. And scotch is whiskey that is made in Scotland. And bourbon is whiskey that is made in America. The difference, in addition to the terroir, as the French would say, and the fact that it's two different countries of origin, Scotch is made with barley as the main malt ingredient, and bourbon with corn as the main mash ingredient, with some rye to a greater or lesser extent in some of the bourbons as well. So it's like, but the process and the place that the spirit occupies in the society, in the community, is more or less the same. And so that's, I think that's what I got out of what you said about it being ironic.
Yeah, certainly. That's what I meant. So, I'm going to say, I'm going to blend the terms, two terms that you use, and go straight in and say, I'm smelling candied fruit.
Ah, okay. Fair enough.
You know what? There's a kiss of sunshine in here. I don't know how else to describe that. Maybe I'm just being influenced by this. This is a golden amber, man.
Yeah. It's now keep in mind why the Macallan people would be excited to hear you say that is because they don't add color.
Yeah,
it's just from sitting in the sherry oak for the 18 years. And to hark back one more time to something that Reed said, you know, for organic minded folks. You know, the fact that this is just the barrel and the alcohol is That's all it is. The barrel, the alcohol, and time. And it don't get more organic than that, you know?
That is true craft. Mm-hmm. Well, for sure. I think it is time for the palate, man.
Uh-oh. Here we go. So, you know, I'm going to do... You went straight in. I'm going to do the wake up my palate thing with let the first sip just coat my tongue with the oils. And
I thought that was what I was doing.
You know, not really trying to taste yet for me. But
yeah, I'm not giving any notes. I'm just going to say this is this is a different experience to the 12-year.
Oh, yeah. Oh, is a qualitative difference.
If you are thinking, you know, this is 12 with just a little more oomph. This is, let me tell you, split this with a few friends and experience that, because it is not the 12.
So two different things, right? The 12-year-old double cask, which is what we've had, is different than...
Oh, we've had the double cask. Yeah, okay, I thought that was also a sherry.
No.
Okay.
The Sherry Oak Range is different. The double cask is... It spends half the time in the regular American oak and then half the time in European oak. Mm. The Sherry Oak is exclusively done aged in the Sherry Oak.
Okay.
And so that's one of the major differences in both in terms of color and also in terms of flavor. The Sherry Oaks have this candied fruit and nut vibe with banana bread and I'm trying to think of Bahamian flavors that people would be familiar with. In addition to the, you know, like vanilla and brown sugar and maybe coconut as well. It's so complex. But
listen, if you've ever had a sherry, or even just a, I wouldn't say a regular red wine, but, you know, one of the more what I call meaty varieties, that finish, I'm getting a sherry finish on the palate here. I don't... That is super surprising to me. And not in a bad way at all.
Yeah, you can definitely taste the sherry aging, for sure.
Oh, that is... That is pleasant. With a spicy kick, I'm getting some pepper, more like black pepper.
But it's so smooth, oh my God.
Tinge of cinnamon. And then that fruity sherry finish, you know, that nice aging. Oh.
All right. So
that is a true delight. Thank you so much.
I am this is the Macallan 18-year-old Sherry Oak cask. And I was thinking about this, and I'm definitely saying now we need to start a list. Right? We need to start a list, and that list has to be legit. I
don't understand what you mean. Like, how is a list not legit?
I mean that we have to be cruel and harsh when we are judging whether a scotch gets on the list and what place that scotch might enjoy within said list. And I'm going to say the Macallan 18-year-old Sherry Oak cask definitely goes on the list. At present, I am hesitant to see how this is not number one on the list.
You know, I'm gonna join you in this endeavor.
Oh, wow. I fully expected you to push back.
Caveat. Every time we do the list.
Yeah, but we don't do the list officially. That's why I'm taking notes. That's my point.
Okay. I'm going to read out all of the caveats until the listener is sick of it and you stop doing the list.
We're not going to stop. The list is, the way I see it, what we are going to be doing with this list is public service.
Yeah. But
at the end of the end of the year, we're going to publish the list.
Mm-hmm.
And the neophyte beginning scotch drinkers will have, and those who are journeymen and veterans will have a roadmap of scotches that they know for sure. At least Quincy and Matthew liked them.
They know for sure that Quincy and Matthew liked them. That's all that matters. That's where you and I diverge. That's all that matters. Is like, I think the fork in the road for us, because I'm gonna say that the good whiskey is the whiskey you like. Mm-hmm. So you know, if you don't agree with Q on this one, y'all be all right. Don't worry about it. I'm going to join up to this list and say that you should definitely try the ones that we put on.
So we got to get 5 points per scotch.
5 points? Yes. See, this is so reductive. This is so reductive.
Reductive how?
The complexity.
Right.
Of a scotch or any whiskey.
Yes.
Of worth your time and money.
Yes.
Reduced to 5 points.
Yes.
To be on not a list to try. The list.
Yes.
I proceed, sir. I
the points are not to be apportioned according to any criteria other than how it makes you feel. If this is a 5 out of 5 scotch, then this is a 5 out of 5 scotch.
Okay.
If this is a 3 out of 5 scotch, then this is a 3 out of 5 scotch.
I think the name of the list is The List.
Yes.
Open bracket with all of the caveats that Matthew will enumerate at the end of the list. Close bracket.
So The List, caveats included. Because I'm sure that I will have some caveats of my own to enumerate and elucidate as well. I'm calling this one 5 out of 5, maybe 6 out of 5.
I'm going to go 4.8 out of 5.
Okay.
As one of my English teachers told me, there's no such thing as a perfect A.
Fair enough.
Mind you, I got a perfect day once or twice. So, you know, time and place.
4.8 out of 5. I see you leaving room.
One must.
I see you leaving
room. In my philosophy, one must.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I stand by my 5 out of 5 only because at the end of the year, I cannot imagine that there will have been more than a handful of scotches that we've tried that get a full 5 points. I just can't imagine that. Because we've tried some incredible and exquisite bottles of scotch so far. We've tried some that have been big swings and big misses, like I believe the peat monster was a swing and a miss for you.
Yeah, you know what? As I was telling Reed, I gotta start this journal because I honestly can't tell you which one it was.
the peat monster. I think that the Port Charlotte was also kind of a so-so one for you. I thought it was okay. The Brickladdick Port Charlotte is, you know, is a good one, but it wasn't like, it's not a 5 out of 5. But I think the list needs to start today, not retroactively. We're not putting anything on the list from before.
No problem.
We'll have to if we want them to be submitted for consideration on the list, then we'll have to have them here on the show beginning from today going forward.
Today.
Yeah. So, as this wonderful Sherry Oak cask, 18-year-old Macallan, is opening up in the tulip glass, and as those wonderful fruit flavors are moving forward, and the spice is mellowing out, and that structure is setting up so that the oils can hold all of those different experiences, I cannot help but look out the window at this wonderful harbor in front of us, beautiful sea and the sun, and think to myself, you know, Q, you this is a pretty good life you live.
Oh boy.
Oh boy. Okay. And then I turn to my WhatsApp, and I see in my WhatsApp a complaint of a nebulous, undefined nature, but clearly with some energy behind it. And so this being the Sunday Scotch Society, where we invite people to join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation, I want to open up the floor for my co-pilot to tell me in exquisite detail, what is your beef, Matthew, with the Play and Films Control Board?
What is my beef? I don't believe that I said that I had a beef. I simply outlined to you that I think we should touch in passing on them as an entity, not as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
The board is always changing.
Mm-hmm.
Even within the term of a government.
Yes.
This is not about any one person who is there or has been.
Right.
Right. I simply find it interesting that this, dare I say, anachronistic entity is still around and
is still banning movies?
Still, every now and again, becomes a relevant topic of discussion. Not that I think that they are relevant. Not, and again, I'm talking about the entity, not mm-hmm. the people in it.
Mm-hmm.
I make no secret that I don't think that this is an organization, well, a governmental entity that should exist. I don't have complete information on exactly why it was instituted, but I can say with extreme confidence that it was a tool of information control beyond just quote unquote protecting the public from the beginning. And I know it's a tool that is open to easy abuse. And I know that beyond the control of information is also an instrument that is used to placate and to reward. So what I mean by that is that the government of the day, no matter which color you subscribe to, will place people there to, you know, either they have an interest. More often than not, they just want to reward people and make them feel important for a time. The criteria that these decisions are made on is nebulous, will change as the board changes through people coming and going. And also, its makeup is intended to keep particular constituencies feeling as if they are relevant and have a particular say in things of the day, right? So I think it continues to serve a purpose. That purpose is not its stated purpose. Mostly I think it's funny because in the meantime, since it was implemented, something called the internet happened. Mm. TVs are huge these days in terms of size. You walk in and, you know, someone's window is completely covered. Whereas when you and I grew up, tiny bit smaller.
There was such a thing as a 13-inch screen
TV. Oh, so many good episodes of Sport Sesame Billy. Street on that.
Oh, yeah. You're too young for Sport Billy. Sorry.
So.
Speed Racer. Mighty Mouse.
Hey. Great, great cartoons. Anyway, so. Yeah, I just wanted to say in passing, I thought it was funny that an appeal was lodged, mm-hmm. and that the minister made a public statement that the appeal was lodged and, you know, it's going through, mm-hmm. and that everybody should be cordial with each other, etc. Mm-hmm. I know it's annoying to those people who wanted to see the film in the theater, you know, it's a communal experience, and that's great.
You are speaking from a perspective of one who knows.
I didn't mention the name because I don't think it matters what it was.
It may not matter for the point you're making, but it matters in that I feel like people who don't know may feel like they are being deliberately left out of the conversation.
Well, why don't you...
I'm one of those people.
Opine.
I am one of the people who's been deliberately left out of the conversation.
You know that a film was banned.
I am aware that a film was banned.
The full name of this film, which is an anime, a style of animated film popularized and mostly made in Japan, mm-hmm. is Demon Slayer.
That's the one I'm talking about. It
Kimetsu no Yaiba.
Yes, it was banned for demonic content.
To
right
the Hashira training. Yeah. Now, was it banned for quote unquote demonic content?
Yeah,
because this excerpt from the article that I'm reading is not a direct quote.
Right? A paraphrase,
but okay. it says that the head of the Film Control Board defended the decision on that anime movie, saying, and I am now quoting the article, mm-hmm. the film has no understandable plot and is not in English. Full stop. Now,
okay.
Perhaps this article or another article goes on and gives other criteria. However, this article leads with this. One would think that if it was banned on quote-unquote demonic content, that would bubble up. I would imagine that certain constituents on the board, mm-hmm. representing the, let's say, the organized religion. Let's see.
Okay. I was going to say anti-demon faction, but okay.
I think the anti-demon faction is a much larger, if you want to do a Venn diagram, that ain't... a circle that encompasses this yes. particular constituency.
Yes, I agree.
So I would not be surprised if there were complaints. However, at the same time, I would be surprised because this is a demon Slayer, which puts it firmly in the anti-demon contingent, one would think. All right, so apparently we're banning films today, 2024, and this is important to the point that I made when this first stirred up last month. 2024 we're banning because there's no discernible plot, and it's not in English. Okay, this may or may not have been the case before 2024, and may or may not be the case moving past this point in 2024 and into the future. Why? Because the constituents that make up the Film Control Board
will change
time to time. There is no hard criteria on how this is done. And it's just, it's funny. There was a point in my life, right, before we had broadband, we were still on dial-up, where I thought, you know, it would be a great life's accomplishment to dismantle this institution, both in a practical sense and just philosophically, because what it represents philosophically is you do not know enough to make a decision for yourself to see a film in public. We can't control your home, but we certainly won't let a bunch of you guys get together and pay an entity to put that on a big screen. You do not have what it takes to make that decision for yourself.
But
as it just becomes more and more irrelevant, it's just getting funnier and funnier to me. And, you know, next year, some other silly thing is going to be banned. And I'm just going to laugh. Meanwhile, broadly speaking, largely irrelevant. And I just cannot wait until the board, instead of having anti-no-plot factions or anti-foreign language factions on it, has anti-chicken factions or anti-particular film color palettes or anti-carnivore or anti-vegan or, you know, just take your pick. It's just going to be silly into the future, and it's just representative of where certain things are in the bureaucracy and the culture as a whole. And I got to laugh.
Or,
please.
Tear it down. But it's the same impulse.
Does the energy?
Yeah, I know. I don't know, buddy. But it's the same impulse that people have when they want to start or continue the argument about the government prohibiting Bahamians from gambling in casinos inside the country.
That at least, right? I'm not arguing for it, but that at least is based on potential terrible financial outcomes, right?
No, that's not what it's based on.
It's the argument.
No.
Yeah, that's what the argument...
That's not what the argument is based on.
Oh, yes, sir.
The argument is based on exactly the same argument that you proposed for the Play and Films Control Board, that you do not have what it takes to make a decision for yourself about the manner in which you will behave.
That part I'm not disagreeing with. What I'm saying...
That is the fundamental point at which... I understand what you're saying, right? What I'm saying
to
is,
you, because you don't seem to be representing that.
No. What I'm saying is the people that I'm referring to who are willing or continue this argument, their argument does not stem from they are arguing about the financial consequences. They're not they don't dispute that the ban may have prevented some Bahamians from gambling away their family's financial future. But their argument is how dare you make that decision for me? How dare you tell me as an adult?
Yeah, you're talking about
that. That there is an activity that goes on in my country,
mm-hmm.
for which it is perfectly legal for people to engage in, but I am prohibited from engaging in this perfectly legal activity in my own economy.
Yeah, that's the argument against the ban. I was talking about from the perspective of the government using right. the excuse, because this could be potentially for a few people catastrophic,
and
we're gonna take this action.
Which I hear, and I Obi used to say that crap all the time, God bless him.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact was and is that is a that's a straw man argument.
Of course it is.
Right? All of these things are, and this is my point. I'm supporting your point. But I feel like you feel like I'm disagreeing with you, and I'm very concerned about that because I'm agreeing with you 100%.
Listener, you know, just take it with a grain of salt.
Take everything.
I'm not telling you.
Except the five out of five that I've given the McKellen.
Yeah, it's this is definitely a solid 4.8.
Mm. I'm going to get that 0.02%. You stay right there. The extra 200s, right?
Listen, with every sip, I go up
0.01. yeah, so the fact is that the Commonwealth of the Bahamas is one of the most efficiently run and effectively run.
Oh, I gotta hear how this ends.
Nations in the Caribbean, certainly one of the most efficient and effectively run small island developing states. In speaking in broad strokes, and one of the most important elements of efficiency and effectiveness in a community, especially a SIDS like us, is the story around energy, mm-hmm. the story around how energy is produced, how it is transmitted and distributed, the cost, the efficiency of the processes, the effectiveness of the infrastructure, and for the most part, the Bahamas gets poor marks on a micro level, but fairly decent marks on a macro level. Right, when you get up at a high level, you're flying around 10,000 feet. The fact is, the power is on most of the time. You could say it's on all the time, and it's so unusual when the power is off mm-hmm. that people still get angry, as opposed to being, you know, laissez-faire and saying, as they might be in parts of India or parts of Africa, where the power generation is so spotty that it's a gamble whether there'll be power today or not.
Right.
State-provided power. So the Bahamas has steady power that is sufficient to run the needs of the citizens, both commercial and non-commercial, at an industrial level for the manufacturing community, and at the personal level for the one bedroom apartment or the person who is living in inefficiency. It's only when you drill down into the micro level of scrutiny that I think we start to really see the cracks that exist in our electricity story, in our power and energy story. And there, I think, is where our conversation on that issue for this conversation begins.
Yeah, that's an interesting analogy of the 10,000 foot view and drilling down into the micro. Because how severe an issue is in terms of cracks really depends on materials. Are we talking about an aircraft? Are we talking about a roadway? Are we talking about, you know, a gas-fed steam turbine? You know, the blemishes and the precision that you need for these various things differs, right? So I want to bring that in to your analogy, because the complexity of an economy is like that, right? What material are we working with? What is the overall outcome that we're looking for, right? And in free market economies, you sort of put forward something that someone might want. It finds a market, demand sort of rises, supply rises with it. There are pricing dynamics, et cetera, right? But overall, an economy can be thought of in one way, and most economists don't think this way, but most physicists, and certainly physicists turned economists, do, and some other economists, more traditionally trained. An economy can be thought of as the change or the use of energy being changed into something useful. So whether you think of a laptop or a toothbrush or your glasses or the boat cruising the harbor, there's energy input there. And the efficiency with which you convert that into something useful, which includes something wanted, because there's no use to it if no one wants it, that encompasses what an economy is. Now, there's a bunch of little things in there, like what is doing the conversion? You know, is it humans? Is it machines? How are they using that energy? What are the strategies, not just short term, but medium and long term? For instance, we dug up a lot of energy out of the ground, be it from coal or oil or gas, and now we externalized the cost of that. We took it from a bank that was already there. We came and we found that there. It's basically stored up solar energy over millions of years. But we didn't account for it in our equations. And so we just pumped that into the air, and now we have accelerated human-caused climate change, right? We could argue about specifics about climate change at a different time, right? But that is an example of the details of accounting for the overall equation of turning energy into something useful. And it's going to be the product that you want, and it's going to be waste. That waste can be in energy itself, heat, et cetera, or in products that you don't want, trash, carbon dioxide, et cetera, right? So that's the background. The Bahamas is known for tourism. We are very good at turning energy into experiences for tourists. Part of that is because the cost of doing so is in a sweet spot, which has a lot to do with our geography. We're right next to the U.S. So an equivalent product further away is going to cost them more, right? So there is how much the initial energy costs, and then there is how efficient are we at turning that into something. We are very terrible at turning it into steel, for example. We have no forges, we have no ore imports, etc. Okay, so here we are. The costs are not astronomical here for electricity. They're not great. They are heavily subsidized in one form or another. There are rumblings around BEC at the moment. However, there's also the reality that the cost for solar is still continuing to plummet on a per watt basis. So I want to ask you, if you see A, BPL stabilizing at the administrative level to the point where it could start paying for itself and maybe even investing in some of the problem areas, mainly the transmission network? Or B, are we just going to have it where the costs continue to come down and just like the introduction of cell phones, first the rich people will have them and then more and more people will want them, need them in terms of solar power and alternative energy setups? Because you may say at the macro level, yeah, everything is cool, but you know, how many cracks does it take before the machine has a very, very serious problem? I'm actually quite concerned about BPL. Not so much because of the technical people there, the overall infrastructure, although it really, really needs an upgrade. I'm really concerned about the political situation, the administration situation, and how that also holds back the development of your own private supply. So, you know, I'm seeking you, having had some experience with BPL, like, where do you think things are going?
Okay. To answer your first direct question to me, yes. There are ways that BPL can pay for itself and start investing in T&D and the other vitally and drastically needed investments. In fact, the last board of directors laid out a very clear and deliberate path for achieving exactly that outcome. They told the Bahamian people what they wanted to do. The Bahamian people punched them in the face, mm-hmm. and then cussed them out and then said, okay, well, might as well get started, because the plan made sense. It was, in case people don't remember, the introduction of a national utility investment bond fee on your monthly bill from BPL. The money raised from, the fee would be used as a security to secure a loan from private equity partners who would be convinced to give BPL the loan at concessionary rates based on the fact that there was this charge on the bill and that it is a government entity. That charge would have allowed BPL to borrow up to, I think it was $500 million that they were looking at borrowing, to retire the debt that is plaguing BPL and invest $40 million in T&D, invest another couple of tens of millions in new generation and shoring up the generation, and invest money in the efficiencies at the administrative level, people training, hiring staff complements that are necessary. All of this was done on the premise that even with the introduction of the fee, the cost of electricity would be lower because of the efficiencies already created at BPL. to demonstrate the cost of electricity between 2000 and 19 and 2020 was one amount, mm-hmm. and then between 20 and 21 was another amount. The amount was 25% reduced in 2022, well, 20 fiscal 21-22, between over fiscal 2021. You could look at any bill, mm-hmm. and I did this as the director of public relations, just pulled three random bills and blacked out the people's names and account numbers and showed the 25% reduction in every bill. When you add back the 10 to 15% that the National Utility Investment Bond fee would add to the bill, mm-hmm. you're still down 10% from your previous bills. And that was the value of the hedging program, which would have locked in the rates that were currently set and let those rates last the length of the utility bond. So all of that is a complicated way to say yes. I think that, not to say that that was the only way. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is there was a way that has already been presented and proven to be effective enough to get support from the commercial sector, the political sector, the public sector, and the private sector.
But it didn't.
The only reason it didn't was because there was an election coming up, mm. and the prime minister at the time didn't have the confidence to pull the trigger and just go out and get the fee, go out and get the bond.
If that is the case, go on.
I don't want this part of the conversation to devolve into, did Minnis get it right?
No.
Right, you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
There's a danger there in talking about this, because I was at BPL at the time.
Right.
I don't want people to think that I'm talking about what the team I was a part of did. I'm answering your question about whether there is a way that BPL can pay for itself.
Right. I'm just, I want to clarify though, right, that I would have continuing concerns. Not that the plan wouldn't work, right? You laid out a specific scenario as to why that was rejected at the time, right? Mm-hmm. But correct me if I'm wrong, that is not the current plan.
And here we finally...
Well, this is my concern.
Yeah.
Is a political one, mostly. Then any number of sensible, implementable... you know, workable plans, both can and in the past have been presented, right? My concern is, will there ever be political will behind something that is sensible, or are other incentives going to derail that?
So I think what we are seeing now is the answer to your question. Rather than fix BPL, it has been for at least the past three administrations, political administrations, it has been determined to be more efficient to privatize BPL. Right? And politically, it's not acceptable to privatize the whole company. So the way that administrations have dealt with that is to talk about privatizing parts of BPL. In the current instance, I believe the conversation surrounds privatizing the generation of electricity. That was what was contemplated under the past administration as well. As allow private sector to generate electricity, feed it into the grid for a certain fee, while the government maintains ownership of the transmission and distribution grid, and therefore ownership of the customer service, and keeping people's, you know, electricity safe. But that is a decision that is a decision based on the fundamental view that many people hold, that government shouldn't be in business, that government can't run business effectively. Never mind that that's the whole point of having a board of directors appointed by the government, is for the government to bring in the expertise from the private sector to properly and efficiently run these businesses. But the fact that those boards are beholden to the government of the day for their policy input is often considered problematic, right? Because every board of directors has, since that I've been aware, including going back to Leslie Miller, has a plan for introducing renewable energy sources in a more aggressive way into the power grid and the power mix that BPL puts out. No administration has been able to successfully, prior to the Donovan Moxie board, Whitney Hastie, CEO, BPL, they were the first people to introduce a solar grid in the Bahamas. Ragged Island is run on a solar grid right now because of the work that they did. They were building solar grids in Abaco and planning for Eleuthera and Grand Bahama. What I'm saying is that the company has a history of being able to do these things and having the expertise resident in the company to accomplish these goals. The challenge is and will continue to be, as you are alluding to, the influence of the political directorate on how BPL is run. So the question is not, in my view, can BPL run itself? Is there a way that BPL can pay for itself and invest? Yes. The answer to that question is yes. But to me, the real question is, when will there be political will and political courage to allow any of the incredibly reasonable and effective plans and strategic plans that have been presented for BPL to take place? And the problem with that is BPL hires, the staff is about 800 people in the staff, and that is a significant number of jobs that the government is not willing to let go of the ability to control. And that's where we are.
Well, we will take this up again later. I toast to your freedom to be out and about now.
Indeed.
Thank you for the drum.
And at the end of it, it's that there's a nut that I, it's like almonds, but like sugared almonds.
I'm getting almost pecan.
Okay. That's fine. You know, your taste buds need Jesus, but, you know, nonetheless.
Okay, Mr. COVID.
Not while I have
not while you're drinking,
18-year-old scotch in my mouth. What happened to you? Anyway, that's the Rovia, ladies and gentlemen.
Ciao.